Know the Source on One Radio Network.
Good morning. Good morning. This is OneRadioNetwork.com. The telephone number is 888-663-6386. Email patrick@OneRadioNetwork.com.
Or for the guys, they can just look at their hair and, you know, see if it turns gray. You know, it'll happen. Look at the president. Wouldn't it be hilarious? If President Trump is one of the, starts getting gray, he'll have a great head of hair if it's all gray. Man, I'm not going to wish that on him. He seems like he's got pretty tough skin. I think he's going to do fine, you know? 888-663-6386. Email patrick@oneradionetwork.com. This is from Tom. Oh, he's actually in Austin, Texas. I've heard that interest-bearing accounts are really good things to have because they are more private, not reportable, such things like this. Can you tell me if interest-bearing accounts are a positive thing to have? Didn't even say it right.
Non-interest-bearing. Yeah. I was thinking, what the hell? How could he be totally backwards?
Non-interest-bearing accounts. Sorry, my bad.
Right. Well, what happens with an interest-bearing account
is
like any time, very paltry interest.
Sure.
But you also get along with that interest a report from the paying entity that says, oh, by the way, we paid Joe this much interest last year.
Yeah, $12.08, whatever.
Which reveals the existence of the underlying asset.
The account.
Yes.
Okay.
And it can be quite cumbersome to have to file a 1099 tax return with your tax return for $12 in interest or whatever.
Right.
So for me, this is the era of passive income generators.
Passive income generators.
Yes.
All right.
So a passive income generator is one which doesn't throw off income and doesn't throw off a 1099. Now, in the case of non-interest bearing accounts, it's not a very good place to keep your money because you're not getting any interest, and the value of the money is falling as you hold it. So, you know, for me, for a short-term investment, maybe non-interest-bearing accounts make sense. But as a general rule for my customers and for myself, keeping money, I'm using my air quotes, in the bank is a foolish way to store wealth.
Of course, yes.
You keep enough in there for what you need, you know, what you're going to spend. But don't just keep your long-term savings in a non-interest-bearing account. That's the worst thing you can do.
But there's no... Is there any privacy?
More privacy.
Is there more privacy?
Well, the existence of the account isn't revealed to regulatory agencies because there's no 1099, there's no underlying asset to report. So it does give you more privacy. Now, if they go looking for it, they'll easily find it.
Of course.
Yeah. Right. But, you know.
Since there's no 1099.
Correct.
Right. Yeah. Is there a benefit to it as far as you have told us that when you deposit.
It's not your money anymore.
Well, even with a non-interest bearing.
Especially with a non-interest
bearing.
Really?
Why especially?
Well, because, you know, the banks are generally the ones that hold these non-interest bearing accounts.
Of course.
And so any problem at the bank translates immediately into a problem for you.
No matter what kind of account you have.
Correct.
Okay.
So, but if it's at a bank, especially, as opposed to a brokerage house, you know, like a Merrill Lynch or something along those
lines. Safer there?
Which is a bank now. You can't tell them apart anymore.
Yeah, safer there. Speaking of that, President Trump has suggested, boy, you're talking about poking the giant in the eye. I can't even believe he's saying it. Mm. What do you think? I'm really open to the idea, he says, of breaking up the big banks.
Well, he didn't really say break. Well,
didn't he?
Well, here's the concept,
okay,
right? What happened,
the quote.
If we back up, maybe he did say break up the big banks.
I thought he did.
What he meant was simply this, that once they repeal Glass-Steagall, Bill Clinton and the crowd, repeal Glass-Steagall.
98, right?
Right, 99, yeah, actually, he's on his way out. He said that the legislation said that if you're a commercial bank and you're taking deposits from the public, you can't mix with an investment bank that's taking money in to invest in things. And they separated the two. So if you're a bank, you have to decide which one of these you want to be. And many banks chose to have one division in each, right? They had an investment bank, J.P. Morgan, and then they had a commercial bank, Chase. But then once the legislation allowed for the re-merger of these entities, then that's exactly what they did. All of the big investment banks sought out a commercial bank and vice versa, and they married and became a single entity. So Travelers, Citigroup, and J.P. Morgan and Chase and multiple others formed these mega entities where there was no longer a separation between the investment side of the bank and the commercial side of the bank. And they tried to put things in place such as the Volcker Rule, which said you can't take your money and invest in things. But the banks, as Jamie Dimon of J.P. Morgan pointed out, found ways around that legislation. And so it really hasn't affected them at all. Many people, financial analysts, politicians, finance people, have suggested that Glass-Steagall, more than anything else,
should go back.
Well, it gave us the crash.
Of course. Sorry. I was ahead of you. I was behind you.
And so as a result, we should go back it's a safer environment when the investment banks are not allowed to take depositors' money and make proprietary gambles. It's like, oh, I want to deposit $100,000 in the bank. Great. I was just on my way to Vegas. Uh-huh. I'll take that with me and gamble. And that's I'll let you know how I do. Yeah. And by the way, if I make money, I'm going to keep it. But if I lose money, I'm going to turn to you and tell you that I lost your money, or to the government.
Which is the way it's been since 99.
Correct. Okay. And so in the crisis, in the mortgage-backed securities crisis, what had happened is the banks had loaded these mortgage-backed securities into their portfolios. And then when the bottom fell out and they were illiquid and they couldn't sell the mortgage-backed securities, now they couldn't pay the depositors back. So if the government, federal, hadn't stepped in and said, here's a TARP, cover the whole thing up, the people that had money deposited in these banking institutions would have suffered. Hmm. And now they've adjusted the rules. Now we have these new bail-in rules that say if that happens again, we're going to turn to the depositors first.
Oh, that's always good.
To try to rectify the problem. And then if the depositors can't fix the problem, then we'll turn to the bailout mechanism. The FDIC is on the hook for all of it. And so we've created a hazard that Mr. Trump says maybe we should go back to what it was. Yeah. That's what he means by breaking up the big banks. So the idea that he's somehow going to raid business and, you know, that's viewed as a negative in the marketplace. But the harsh reality is that from 1934 till 1999, Glass-Steagall was the rule. And during that entire period, we may have had, you know, little minor upsets in the stock market and the investment markets, et cetera, but never a banking crisis like we did in 2008.
So, no, I know that FDIC will insure some money. If folks have a lot of money in the bank, and probably none of our listeners, but, well, it could be. But, I mean, can you actually buy insurance that would cover you, and if you were going to get bailed in, could you buy it?
Not directly, but you can structure a product that would pay off in such an environment.
Would you?
Yes.
You can do it. It'd be like Lloyd's or somebody like that on one of these.
Yes, you'd have to structure a product. I don't know that there's one currently available, bail-in insurance, but I do know that anyone who keeps large sums of money in the banking system,
I know, it's just not a good idea.
Really needs to look twice and ask themselves why they're doing that. But, because it's sort of like your cannon fodder. Your money is cannon fodder. You're providing ammunition for the enemy.
But then, I mean, what about people that are pretty wealthy and they got a few million and stuff like that? I mean, it's
fixed
not,
assets.
It's not,
I can't.
Yeah, but
I
it's
don't.
Not really reasonable by to have like a couple million dollars in gold or something, is it? I guess.
Why not?
Yeah, I guess. Why not is right. Yeah.
Why not?
It's real money, of course. What am I thinking?
Yeah, I don't understand that logic.
Okay. All right. I got you. Why not?
Yeah, I have clients with, you know, multiple millions in numismatic coins. It's a great alternative investment. And granted, they also have multiple millions in stocks and multiple millions in bonds and real estate, et cetera.
Uh-huh.
The way that I look at it is diversification is the key to success. And so in any portfolio, especially one that's loaded with debt, meaning bond instruments, where you're loaning money to someone in exchange for a fixed rate of return, those portfolios most definitely need the inflation hedge provided by numismatic coins.
So our listeners around the world, if they look at all of their assets, right?
Yes,
and then they want to take a percentage. What would be, it's a terrible question.
20%.
20% is the
reasonable. Even the most prudent financial advisor will say 10%. So, you know, 20 doesn't still even put you in that bullish category. Now, if you look at
20,
the top,
you just kind of have your 20% of your stuff, you're just having your toe in the water.
That's it, yeah. As I've said in the past, I have 85% of my own money in numismatic coins, but, you know, I'm a coin dealer. However, if you look at the top five asset classes we were just talking about.
Oh, yeah,
about,
I found that, Matt. Go ahead, yeah.
Well, you'll find that, you know, commodities and fixed asset, fixed supply commodities are in that top five category. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's just over and over again throughout history. I have a 35-year research paper on numismatic coins versus just bullion. And, I mean, you could see over the last 35 years, keeping a portion of your wealth in my field, in numismatic coins. But if you expand that into the collectibles arena, and now suddenly you include art and antiques, mm-hmm. and old automobiles and antique musical instruments, and it broaden the field, wow, you really find that they really are always in the top five asset categories. So if you divided your portfolio among those top five asset classes, and you said 20% in one, 20% in two, 20% in three, and so on, hey, you got the top five, 20% each, you're good to go. Mm-hmm.
Are there coins that people can get from you that that are easy to get into without a lot of money?
Yes and no.
Yes and no.
I mean, yes, you can, but they aren't the best investment coins in many instances.
But still, wouldn't it be good to have real money, even if they're just not the best ones?
Well, you know,
I don't know.
I've made it a policy at the firm that we're not just going to sell coins because they're round. If we, you know,
hey, we got some round stuff
here. Yeah, they're round, and so you should buy them. Now, if we want to see the investment potential, what could possibly affect the upward value of these things? Now, if we're talking about numismatic coin, that's one where the collectible value outstrips the bullion content, or the what we call the intrinsic value of the coin. And if you're counting on commodities in general rising in price, which many investors are, and many analysts are definitely predicting that, if you look at copper and silver and gold and platinum and palladium and so forth, these commodities generally have an upward cycle to go through in the future. There was a super cycle that sort of started a decade or two ago, where because of the inflation, because of the additional money in circulation, that these commodities will increase in price. So if you're going to buy a coin where the bulk of the value is not in the collectability or the numismatic value, but in the intrinsic value,
yeah,
the silver content, the gold content, the platinum content, and so on, then at least you have the increase in commodities to hang your hat on. So I guess your statement is correct, that to the extent the commodities rise, then yes, these very common coins that don't have a lot of numismatic value will also rise. Uh-huh.
So with all the central banks printing, mm-hmm. like there's no tomorrow, mm. all of them, mm-hmm. so what is keeping the gold price? I mean, it's pretty boring lately. I mean,
it's the debt ceiling right now. The debt ceiling, the inability of the federal government to borrow the money that it needs to operate. And so they're taking money from existing sources within the trust funds and spending it as though it was revenue.
I see. Okay.
And so, believe it or not, I mean, this has kept a lid on inflation, and it's kept the traders flat-footed. But now if they sign this increase, this funding increase, et cetera, it'll be business as usual at the Treasury again, and money will enter circulation a heck of a lot quicker as new bonds are created. Now, I'd like to believe that they're just going to sop money out of the existing supply, but I know that that's not the case, and I'll keep a close eye on the balance sheet.
So,
I believe as soon as these Treasury bills, bonds, and notes hit the market, sometime 10 days from now, you'll see a reversal of that trend.
Uh-huh. If somebody wants to talk to you, what's the deal? How do they do that?
Oh, it's easy. You just pick up the phone and call me, 800-468-2646.
I knew that. 800-468-2646. Andrew Goss, he buys and sells gold coins for a living, and he has people up there. He can talk to you if you'd like to chat it up with him. If you'd like to talk to Andrew personally, something he gets real busy, but they'll kind of put you on a list there and tell him that you're a One Radio Network listener, and they'll kind of get to you more quickly. Just don't tell anybody else. It's May 3rd, 2017. Good morning. Previously with research scientist at MIT, Stephanie Seneff, PhD, and the curious connections between these glyphosates, Roundup, GMOs, and sulfur.
So if you simply put the glyphosate in place of the glycine in the sulfur transferase, you will not be able to get the sulfate from the cholesterol sulfate to some other molecule such as the heparin sulfate. The cell won't be able to defend itself with sulfate if it can't put the sulfate there. But it's really, really important to be able to do that because, for example, cholesterol sulfate, it delivers sulfate to the cells. But in order to deliver it, you've got to take the sulfate off of the cholesterol and put it on something else. And that's what where the sulfur transferase would come in and wouldn't be able to do that.
I know, gets a little geeky, but the point is that without the proper amount of sulfur in the body, and now it's being disrupted because of the GMOs, even more than what it was already doing, it's not good. So we think that this sulfur product that we've been promoting is really helping people to keep everything kind of working well, because this whole sulfur cycle is kind of God's way of keeping the bad guys out and exiting the body. And because our sulfur is absolutely pure with no additives, it's different from almost all the other ones out there. You can click an order, three prices, right on our website, oneradionetwork.com. Previously with Stephen Huer, and why the uniqueness of One World Way delivers exceptional benefits.
A non-denatured, truly pure, truly raw whey protein will only help to raise glutathione. And when you raise glutathione, you have to remember every cell of the body, your pancreas, your liver, brain, all are dependent upon 10% of the protein content and every cell being glutathione, and makes that cell detoxify itself of heavy metals, chemicals, and whatever drugs. And then that makes the cell healthy. And one of the reasons that you have chronic disease is because the cells of the different organs and bodies are producing too little glutathione. They're succumbing to the free radicals. They're succumbing to the toxins, damaging the function of that organ. And that's one of the reasons why One World Way is so profoundly therapeutically powerful, because every cell and every organ depends upon high levels of glutathione. And this is the number one food to fuel it over long periods of time, is glutathione production.
One World Way offers four very, very good tasting flavors: chocolate, vanilla, strawberry, and unsweetened, unflavored. Click and order One World Way right now on OneRadioNetwork.com.
Broadcasting live, weekday mornings, this is listener-supported One Radio Network.
Is the real world of money? May 3rd, 2017. Let's see what we got here in a little email stash. Uh-huh. Okay. Sorry, just my little throat here is not cooperating. From Bruce in California. With the debt service level of private citizens, what was that, 45%?
Yep.
Is it any wonder the GDP is so poor? No one except the gov is buying anything. That's the reason GDP isn't even close to positive. And of course, the peeps aren't complete idiots. They know that they can't really borrow any more bucks against their cards. They just don't buy more doodads. Thank God for the gum or gov, or we'd all starve. You know, it's a good point. I mean, the consumer spending is a big part of all this GDP growth in the country, right? It's a big deal.
Well, it is, but housing makes up the largest component of that. But the federal government is also a big part of GDP, their spending.
Uh-huh. So, by the way, he says, I wonder if the Trumpster is going to go back to calling it like it is, GNP versus GDP. I mean, are we not now nationalist GNP rather than GDP, America First, Buy America, Hire American?
Well, yeah, except the GNP kind of factors in a bunch of foreign activity that doesn't count in the domestic, gross domestic product.
Mm-hmm. But now, I think the GDP was like, what was it, 0.5, Andy, quarter one, 0.5? Or really,
yeah,
really punky. But now the Atlanta Fed is out there saying, that it's going to be 4.5%.
In the second,
how's that possible?
Well, again, once this government spending is unleashed.
Oh, okay.
I think you can expect some dramatic increase in productivity in the second quarter.
So when the Defense Department buys some bombs and blows them up, that helps GDP?
You bet it does.
I think I'm going to put on my tinfoil hat there and see what that's about. Andrew, what will things look like in September for the country and the individuals if they would shut down the government? How long would you think it would last? Do you think that commercial real estate will fall apart with so many stores and malls closing? Well, retail is really having a hard time with Sears, of course, topping the list, and many others are just closing down.
Yeah, and, you know, I think you... The first time I saw this, it was in South Carolina, a zombie mall.
Yeah.
That they actually tore the mall down.
Yeah, I've seen it in Austin. They tear it down.
Tear the mall down.
Yeah, they tear it down. Just tear it down.
So, yeah, I think you'll see more of this. I don't think I would be an investor in commercial real estate right now, unless it was warehouse space. Then you might have a shot there. But in reality, commercial brick and mortar, investing in malls and big box stores and the entities that own them and lease to them, I think is quite risky. In fact, I would put it as one of the most risky investments.
Mm-hmm. I heard on the radio pitching, let's see, what was it called? Boy, I almost wrote it down. Was it Fixed Interest Municipals?
Yeah.
Some place was advertising them. So you have cautioned us that municipals mean that cities or counties are borrowing money to whatever they do.
Yeah, to fund their operations. And the rate of return is fixed. I mean, you're not getting any additional increase if the interest rates increase or if inflation increases.
Mm-hmm. About a couple of weeks ago, you suggested that the boys, Doug and Mel, as we call them, would no more let Le Pen win in France because she wants to get out of the euro. So you're going to hold on to that? Do you think that that's going to be the way it goes with Le Pen?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think they'll do everything in their power to make sure that the euro... centric guy gets in. The one thing they
Macron.
Yeah.
Do you think there's a chance she's going to get in, or what would that
no,
do?
No, I do not. Uh-huh. I do not.
It's not going to happen, huh?
This is basically a socialist country. And, the rap on her, of course, and there's plenty of them, is she's a nationalist. And what is best for France might not be best for the euro, and certainly isn't good for socialism.
But if they would bail, I mean, just say a Trump thing happens and she gets in, it would be a bigger deal than Trump, really.
Yeah, it would.
And she wanted to get out. Would that be the demise, you think, of the euro as we know it?
No, I don't. Yeah. And again, the difficulty that the Brexit is going to bring onto the scene will really make people think twice, at least other countries think twice about doing the same thing.
But so you don't think England's going to do okay with that?
No, I don't.
Doing their own trade deals? I mean,
no, I
that's
think
what this gal is saying. What's her name? Prime Minister May. She's saying, we're going to do fine. We're just going to do a trade deal with everybody. and we'll be able to control our borders, and we're going to be sovereign again.
I think there's going to be extreme difficulty. Extreme. You know, already the banking entities are talking about how many jobs they're moving out of England. I mean, you know, hundreds of jobs are moving out. Yeah. So, I don't know that this will be good in the short term for Britain, and certainly won't be encouraging to those who might consider doing the same thing in other countries. Uh-huh. And France, notwithstanding.
But if Texas or California would bail someday and just do their own thing, you could survive, couldn't you? Couldn't a state survive?
Well, it depends on how much of its own food it grows and you know what it has to import. And the reason you can't draw the parallel between Great Britain and California, Texas or California is because, quite simply, they don't have their own currency.
Oh, I keep forgetting about that. Well, we could do the Texan.
Well, sure, we could.
We could do the Texan or something.
Yeah, of course. Of course.
Then they'd send in F-16s. You know?
Yeah, I mean, you'd really have to.
It's like, that wouldn't be pretty. No, I don't think so. But if you did, I mean, I'm just, you know, just theorizing here. But if you did become your own sovereign state, I guess you could do your own currency. And
well, that's what it would take.
That's what it would take, right?
Essentially.
And then I guess, would a Starbucks in Oklahoma take a Texan?
Right.
You know what I'm saying?
Yes, I do.
It could get very messy.
Exactly.
Could you deposit a Texan
into an
Oklahoma bank? No, it probably wouldn't happen, right? They'd say, well, what are these?
Yeah, what am I supposed to do with these?
What am I supposed to do with these? Boy, that's a problem, boy. When they control the currency, man, kind of got you, don't they? Hmm?
They do,
They really do.
I mean, that is the name of the game. And as Mayor Rothschild said, right?
Oh, Mayor Rothschild. Yeah, we love
Mayor Amschel Rothschild said,
yes.
Give me the power to coin a nation's money, and I don't care who makes its laws.
I don't give a flip. you just give it to me. Hi, Patrick. Back in the early 70s, I remember seeing the cartoon showing the income tax return on a postcard. It had two lines. What did you make? Send it in. got to watch those simplistic solutions, don't you know? So, yeah, Mnuchin is out there, Steve Mnuchin. You got to love this guy.
Yeah.
He is suggesting a big postcard where it would just be, I guess, two things, right? Mortgage. Mortgage interest.
Charitable deductions.
And you would have a separate category if you got a kid. Do you think they'll ever get to that? Do you think they can get to that?
I think they'll definitely add property tax into that list. And yes, they can get to that.
Wow, I think that'd be great.
Yeah.
As long as it's a reasonable, you know, hit and just do it, man.
Yeah.
You think they'll get to it?
I do think they will, yes.
And did you hear you heard the clip, what did we play last week, where Lagarde and the IMF said to Mr. Mnuchin, well, what about all the lobbyists and the tax accountants and the attorneys and all that? And then Mr. Mnuchin said something like, well, the president said he's going to drain the swamp and we'll just drain it.
Drain it. Take him along with us.
See, I don't know what Mr. Mnuchin does in his part time, but I see his name more and more as executive producers of movies. You know, I watch
well,
a lot of movies.
Well, because you're looking for it now.
Well, I do look for it now. I'm always watching who's the executive producer. And boy, old Steve is in there a lot. So can you do that while you still have your gov job? Maybe this is all these movies, of course, have been production for a couple of years. You think he'll still be producing movies?
Well, yeah, I hope so, because he's really good at it.
So what does an executive producer do?
Puts up the money.
Oh, good. You got to go to Golden My Slacks guy.
Sure, he's
he actually
the one.
Puts up the money, or he borrows it, or something.
The one
right?
that takes the risk. Uh-huh. You know, he executive produces the movie and makes sure that it's going to make money.
He makes all the money too.
Well, sure, he makes money.
He
Absolutely.
Gives Tom his $25 million off the top, and you know, you pay for production, and then it's his, right?
That's right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you can make a lot of money as an executive producer, no doubt about.
More than Julie and Tom and.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. Well, sure.
Oh, man.
And after you pay them, you get to keep everything else.
Uh-huh. Yeah. I won't go there. Here's an email. In last week's show, sorry, my sun is shining there. Oh, there. In last week's show, Andy suggested that we research a municipality before buying a home there because of debt and pension obligations.
Correct.
Where would we find such information? Is this the CAFR that Clint Richardson talks about?
Yes.
You've also discussed large national debt coming due soon. Is this mentioned in the H-4-1 release? All right. Two good questions. All right.
Okay, so the maturity schedule or table of federal maturities is what will show you what is coming due.
Okay, let me get there. You can guide me.
Well, it's not on the H-4-1 release.
Man, yeah. That's no fun. Okay. Where is
it? It's in the treasury.gov federal maturities table.
Sure.
So it gives you a scale that shows you what's coming due when. And what I've said is that 60% of the national debt being funded in the short term is due and payable in the next 5 years. So
that's where it tells you that.
Correct. Yeah.
Treasury.gov. Is it easy to find?
Well, it's easy enough to find. Treasury.gov.
And where do I go?
And you go to, you're looking for a maturities schedule.
Yeah, good luck with that. Okay, I won't do that on the air. I got the yield curve. I could probably dig around and find. So they'll actually tell you how much they got and when it's going to mature.
What it's broken up to be, right?
Okay.
So you have the 1 year notes and the 2 years and the 3 years or the five
Treasury.
Years.
Treasury.gov.
Right?
Okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So on the municipal buying a house, yeah. What about that one?
Well, if your entity has an enormous obligation, then you better think twice about purchasing a house because the taxes are inevitably going to increase. If, on the other hand, it does not have such obligations, why, then you can probably count on relatively stable taxes.
But what is this CAFR thing? There? Oh, we know about CAFRs, but this emailer was wondering how the CAFR plays into that.
Well, it just shows you the financial condition of the town that you're considering moving into.
Okay, that's what it does. Yeah, we had looked at it, and you taught us about it before, to show how much money they really have that they don't spend, right?
Correct, yeah. And if you find that you're looking at your CAFR, and what do you know?
Oh, they got a lot of money.
They don't have any money.
They don't have
that they haven't spent, right?
Oh,
yeah, they don't have any money. Then, yeah, you don't want to buy in that town.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's do more emails here. Click, 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 click. Okay. Please have Andrew, define Bitcoin. Define Bitcoin. I guess this person doesn't know what Bitcoin is. From Nancy.
You know, I've heard it described too as you know, electronic gold, but it isn't. It's a distributed ledger, simply, with an unbacked currency or currency unit.
Ledger. Distributed ledger.
Distributed ledger, where you could see or track the movements of a particular electronic currency unit. But I see now where the Bank of England is going to issue. Right?
Did you see that?
Yeah.
That was on my list. Let's stay with the digital currencies for a minute, because I had this in my thing too, that Bitcoin hit an all-time high. It was over $1,500 on the second, and the second guy, Ethereum, that's up too. So people continuing to buy into this blockchain thing.
Correct.
Just because, to this email, just because they believe it's going up. No other reason, right?
Right.
No
right.
other reason.
Right.
Okay. And they believe that there's going to always be somebody that want to buy it when they want to get out. And right now they're right. I mean, you can buy and sell pretty quickly on Bitcoin and all the rest of them.
That's right.
Right? Pretty quickly. So risky, but people play it all the time. And, you know, this thing keeps going up, so I guess they're, you know, they're making money. The people that are in, you know.
Yeah, right. Right? Mm-hmm. There's a paper out there on the web. It's written in 2008, and it's basically a blockchain and a ledger. So it records the rightful owner, of every balance or every Bitcoin in existence.
Really?
And when you make a Bitcoin transaction, you say to the ledger, hey, I want to transfer this Bitcoin to this other owner.
Okay.
And that transactions, those transactions rather, are grouped into a block. And then other people can see and confirm this transaction. So they, in order to create more Bitcoin, other members in the organization or in the community, whatever you want to call it, confirm the transactions in the block and say, okay, yeah, I've looked at this open ledger and followed this blockchain, and every transaction is legit, and I've confirmed now that this is a legitimate block, and they update it on the ledger. And so the next guy to take that Bitcoin can see, oh, I see that it's followed this string, and so I know that it's a real Bitcoin.
Oh, really?
It's not.
Not everybody buys and sells. They don't do all that, do they?
No, oh, no. Yeah. It's the internal mechanisms of the system.
Okay.
But you could essentially transfer a Bitcoin from one address to another in the computer world without anyone ever knowing who did it. You just have to verify that that's your IP address, and that's it. So because you have this cryptocurrency is really the
cryptocurrency. Yeah,
no one knows. It's completely private, and that's what people like about it. Once they take away the privacy, I don't think the Bitcoin's going to be as popular. Or more important, once real distributed ledgers take hold of other assets, this is the problem. Underneath the Bitcoin is nothing. There's nothing under.
I guess that's the real, when you don't know how much, but I guess a lot of this action on Bitcoin and Ethereum would be the privacy, the ability to cross borders, inter-country, and nobody kind of knows what's going on, which is a pretty cool thing. I mean, I'm not talking about illegal, but it's a pretty cool thing to be able to go over to Italy and, you know, whatever, withdraw $1 million in bitcoins and buy some property and get it done.
Yeah, without having anyone know that you're doing
it. Exactly. I mean, you're not talking about evading taxes. You've already paid taxes on the bitcoins you bought.
In theory.
Yeah, well, haven't you?
Well, it depends.
Well,
if you're buying illicit assets, doesn't matter how legal they are.
Uh-huh.
They're still illicit.
Oh, you mean like drugs?
Oh,
yeah.
Yes, like drugs.
You mean, the CIA, they keep, yeah, you know what I'm saying. I mean,
yes, I do.
People have been buying drugs with different forms of stuff since they invented drugs. You know?
Indeed.
Well,
yeah.
You're never going to be able to control
that,
right?
That's the theory,
yeah.
That no matter what you do to stop people from buying or consuming things that they want, they're going to find a way to do it.
Sure.
If there's a way, they're going to find it.
Sure, yeah.
But Bitcoin, right, for the present, facilitates that nicely. And so it's a very popular medium. But if this gold-backed one takes over, that's going to be a different story.
Yeah, so talk about that. This is pretty interesting that the Bank of England, go figure, they said that they're going to do a blockchain...
Gold. Right.
So they claim they're going to have the gold, Andrew, in their vault.
That's right. And
that
a blockchain will enable that to occur. Because the blockchain can tie the specific gold that you're looking at, the specific bar, to the transaction that you're making.
Yeah.
So in the past, that was always the problem, that you had to kind of trust.
You think?
That the other person is holding the gold. So they give you a certificate. Well, so now blockchain will confirm that the gold is actually there.
Oh.
And that, more than anything, I think will...
Could be interesting.
Yes.
Could be very interesting. But
because now you're actually having a cryptocurrency with a blockchain, open ledger, same technology as Bitcoin.
Yeah.
The only difference is
it's
actual gold.
Whoa.
And that, I think, will attract a heck of a lot more people than this cryptocurrency with no substance.
Sure. But I mean, let's be real here. When's the last time banks or governments or central banks did what they said they were going to do?
Well,
you know what I'm saying?
Okay.
I mean, I don't want to get, you know what I'm saying?
Well, yeah, but here, this is an instance where they're putting a product into the marketplace that they're going to make money on, theoretically. So if they want to take advantage of the desire of others to keep their stuff private, then, you know, this will work for them. Not only can you keep it private, but you can get an asset that is a lot more superior to a Bitcoin than anything else.
But would you, would the Bank of England, Andrew, have to back it 1 ounce per dollar? I mean, per, you know what I'm saying?
Well,
I mean, 1 ounce per $1,200?
However they do it. The point is that they'll, the blockchain will certify that the gold is
there.
Actually there.
That's pretty cool.
And that is, that will be an unusual thing and may attract a lot of attention and maybe a lot of investors.
Yeah, yeah. And does the Bank of England have that much gold to deal with?
Well, indeed they do. This is the British Royal Mint. So, yeah.
Yeah,
well,
the British Royal Mint. Yeah. They probably have stuff in the basement nobody knows about.
Yeah. Well, they've been around a long time.
Sure.
Yes, they have.
Yeah.
And so they probably will have a rather successful release.
Mm-hmm. Surprised with China or Russia, who have a lot of gold. I wonder why they haven't done something like that. They're probably going to get the idea now.
Yeah, right. Well, that's the way it goes. You know, look at the way it happened with Bitcoin.
Yeah, I know.
You know, one came out and then I think there's 300 now.
Is there 300 cryptocurrencies?
I think so, yeah. As last I count, nearly 300.
So you think, Andrew Goss, here on this May 3rd morning, that the boys, the banks, the Doug and Mel, they're gonna have to let this continue to go because they can't stop it now.
No.
But they're going to figure out a way how to get transparency.
Exactly.
Right. How to get less privacy.
Right. Less privacy and more keeping it in the system, so to speak. You know, they're still holding the gold. They're still making the transfers. So it's still within their control.
Right. But when people buy and sell Bitcoins and they make a profit, they got to pay taxes on that. There's no 1099.
Right.
Much like gold and silver coins.
Correct.
So you just got to keep your own books.
That's it. Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm sure that the Gov is not pleased with that part of it.
Well, no, they're not pleased with anything that it helps people evade taxes.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, well.
Avoiding them, evading them, two different categories. Yeah.
Yeah. Peter says, I wonder if Andrew has heard the interpretations of history by a woman named Diana Spignola. She seems to think that Jackson wasn't so aggressive against the banks for altruistic reasons, but that he shifted the access to his buddies in New York. She states there was riots in New York against Jackson and his banking policy. She also argues that the vote on the Federal Reserve was not with a vacant Congress, that it was almost a full session, she claims, original sources. Oh, is he talking about the 1913 thing?
I think so. And what all I would say about that...
Do you know this lady?
Oh, no, but I do know the LaRouche view, Lyndon LaRouche. And if you really want to get a criticism of Jackson, you need look no further. Lyndon LaRouche does a real good job of giving you what's viewed as really the negative side of Jackson, that he was only... In his day, they called the institutions that he transferred the money into pet banks. The idea that he favored these banks, and history doesn't prove it, in my opinion. Andrew Jackson had bad experiences in his personal life with banking institutions, so he just didn't like paper money, period. So he didn't really care who issued it. He didn't like paper. He believed in the Constitution's limitation on only gold and silver coins shall be a tender in payment of debt. And he believed that the laws of fraud should apply to anyone who does otherwise. So I'll have to check this out, but it sounds like just the standard textbook LaRouche criticism of Jackson.
And with all these things, it's a yes, no, maybe. I mean, you can read some pretty interesting books about Lincoln and what a nasty guy he was and all that, right? And,
oh, of course, sure. Yeah.
Because he, and I guess all politicians, when they get in the big chair, you know, the big the big desk, you know, they get a little.
But I will point out again that under Andrew Jackson, for the first time in the nation's history, the national debt was paid. And we, from a perspective of a gold and silver coin dealer, you know, there are no practical gold coins that I can offer from before the age of Jackson, because the banks had it so severely locked up that the bulk of money were bank notes. Hmm. And so, you know, I can't offer you an $18.25 $5 gold piece. They're ridiculously expensive. So it wasn't until the age of Jackson that, you know, Americans actually had gold and silver coin to trade with. And I think that, more than anything, solidifies his place to me.
Mm-hmm. Somebody just sent me Hoover Archives Government Research, BLVD, I don't know. They just send me stuff, you know.
Sure. Check it out.
Check it out. Hoover, you know, Herbert, Hubert Hoover. Okay, a couple more, then we'll go to, let's see, Justice Kennedy. You know, oh, this is one. This would be a great one to end on, if you don't mind. This would be from Patrick in East China, Michigan. Ever been there?
No, man, I can't say that I have. Either.
Okay, wait a minute. Before we do that one, because we're going to end on this one, we have another one just popped in. Ask Andy if any gains from Jay, if any gains in rare coin sales are considered capital gains that could be offset by losses of stock or bond sales. Jay in Asheville. Okay.
No, pretty sure that's ordinary income.
So it's always ordinary income.
Yeah.
Even if you've had the gold coin for 5 years?
Well, you can probably declare it how you want as it relates to capital gains and losses. But the taxing side of it, it's not investment income. It's personal property. That's the way they view numismatic coins.
Oh, well, then you'd have to do personal income.
That's right.
Right. You couldn't do capital gains. Or you could, but you could get in trouble. Or they check on it. Okay, so it's personal property. Has it always been like that?
It's always been like that, yeah.
That's interesting. Oh, that's why there's no 1099s.
That's right.
Okay.
That's why you pass them on like furniture.
To your kids and all that stuff.
Exactly. Huh.
Do you have to have something special? Well, I won't go there right now. We'll talk about that later. Okay, this is a cool one we're going to end up on. From Patrick in East China, Michigan. Would you do a real world of money, talk to us like we're a golden retriever, a review of how we got put on the vinyl and not the couch of the Constitution. You want to do that?
Yeah, quickly, because it doesn't take long.
Really?
Yeah, it was a simple enough thing.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay, now tell folks what Patrick is talking about first.
Well, the District of Columbia has the legislative authority in all cases whatsoever without regard to the Constitution. So in a nutshell, they can put stuff into the rules and laws of the District of Columbia that don't relate or don't pay any homage to the Constitution. So let's just say they could do things that are unconstitutional.
Good for them. You mean the White House?
Yeah, well, within the forum. So if you are a U.S. citizen, then you're saying that you're subject to the District of Columbia as your government, right?
I'm a citizen of the 50 United States.
No, well then you're something different.
Okay.
But if you're a U.S. citizen,
right,
then you are subject to the jurisdiction of the District of Columbia.
And how did that happen?
Well, that happened with the Social Security Act.
Ah, good for them.
Because in order to get Social Security, you have to get a Social Security number.
Yes.
And if you have a number, well, then you're clearly subject to the jurisdiction of the federal district government.
Federal district government? Is that different than the federal government?
Yes, it is different,
okay.
Yeah. So, you know, we had two governments, really. We had the national government, which was for everyone, and it was subject to very strict rules that were enumerated in the Constitution, what they could and could not do.
That's one I want.
That's the one you really want. Yeah, but then they have the other one.
Oh, they have another one.
Where they have the right to legislate in all cases whatsoever, and that's the district government.
Hmm.
Well, the district government.
Did they tell us about that when they did that?
Well, no, they didn't. Oh. That's why the attorneys argue that you can sue and for constructive fraud. But in a nutshell, the district government was limited to the District of Columbia and any areas that the state might cede to them. And the Constitution essentially said, you, the district government, can do whatever you want within the district, Constitution notwithstanding. So no one in your district can say to you, oh, that's unconstitutional, because that's your district. The District of Columbia. Are we clear on that?
No, I lost you.
Oh,
sorry,
man.
And I'm pretty good at this, but I did lose you there. So wait a minute. So
the Constitution created a separate jurisdiction for the federal District of Columbia.
The Constitution did?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
What'd they do that for?
So that they could have an area, an enclave, that they were in which they were allowed to legislate in all cases exclusively.
All right.
And that's what they gave
but
them.
Only for the people who live there.
But only for that 10-mile square district.
I'm with you. Okay, I'm with you.
Well, the federal government thought that was such a great idea that they found a way to extend that jurisdiction throughout the United States.
How'd they do that?
By Social Security.
What year was that?
1934. So they require everyone to get a Social Security number.
They don't really require... Well,
no,
they
don't.
They kind of do, but they
don't. They kind of don't.
It's
You're
a
right.
yes, no, maybe.
It's not a law.
But everybody
you
gets
can,
one.
Yeah, you can do what you want there.
Okay.
You can try to live without a Social Security number, but they do make it exceedingly difficult.
Yeah.
But since once you were sort of tied into the District of Columbia, then that put a layer between you and the Constitution.
I hate it when that happens.
And that layer is the District of Columbia.
Mm-hmm.
So as long as you're subject to their jurisdiction, mm-hmm. you can't claim constitutional rights. I'll give you a perfect
example. Wait a minute.
No.
They didn't tell us about that when I was 12 years old and got my Social Security card to do a paper route. I mean, they didn't tell me about
that.
Okay.
That's right.
All right.
When you look at the Constitution and you find that area about trial by jury, right?
Yeah.
Any matter of controversy at common law exceeding $20,
that's right.
A trial by jury, you know, is guaranteed according to the Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
However, you go into some municipal courtrooms where you're being charged with a crime that will certainly make you pay more than $20 if you're found guilty, there's no jury. So,
are you being like seatbelt violation?
Or whatever.
Yeah, or whatever.
Pick your minorest crime you want and ask yourself how many of those are done by a judge in a black robe without a jury.
Okay.
Clear
even,
violation.
Even if your people request it?
That's right.
They just say,
well,
no.
You can't request a jury trial. Oh, there's no jury box. There's no jury.
And that is circumvented by the fact that this...
Well, you're sitting on the plastic.
You're sitting not, on the plastic and not
right.
on the constitutional
that's right.
couch.
That's
what the metaphor you've used with, we're not really on the couch, the organic couch, which is organic cotton and no chemicals. And it's really, and it's got the Constitution right, but we're on a piece of plastic.
That's right, yeah.
Because we're U.S. citizens.
That's it.
And how did we get to be U.S.? Oh, because we got a Social Security number?
Yeah, that and the Civil War, obviously.
Well, wait a minute. I wasn't around the Civil War. What's that?
No, well, none of us were, right? But Mr. Trump caught heat yesterday because he said something like, if Andrew Jackson were... And everybody's saying, wow, what? How did Jackson have anything to do with the Civil War? He was dead for 16 years before it started. Well, John C. Calhoun and the nullification concept, that is clearly from the age of Jackson. And it was a tariff that the federal government wanted to impose. And South Carolina specifically said, no, we don't want this tariff. So they nullified the federal legislation. And so this crisis of states' rights broke out where, you know, essentially the people of the state were saying, your federal government has no right to make this legislation in our district because we're a state in distinct and of ourselves, and you don't have the right to legislate here. And that was the crisis that Andrew Jackson worked out, where they didn't go to war. They certainly could have. South Carolina, that was the beginning, in my view, of the Civil War, in which the South, and South Carolina specifically, said, you don't have a right to tell us what to do in South Carolina. And Jackson backed down. And as a result, the skirmish over states' rights that came to be known as the Civil War never occurred.
Well, when I was a kid, they told me the Civil Rights was about slavery, but let's not go there.
No.
Yeah. Okay. So
not until the second term did Abraham Lincoln invoke slavery as the reason for going to war.
So back to the plastic and the couch. So if you get a Social Security number,
yep,
and if you
that's an adhesion contract. You're clearly now in the District of Columbia. You have a Social Security number. You're in the District of Columbia. And you have to abide by the laws and regulations of the District of Columbia, Constitution notwithstanding.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the key, Constitution notwithstanding.
Mm-hmm.
Because the Constitution does not apply, then obviously all of the constitutional protections don't apply. So that's how you get onto the plastic, by getting into an adhesion contract with the federal district government and declaring yourself a U.S. citizen. Well, then clearly your rights are not derived from the Bill of Rights, but from the Civil Rights Act, and you're a slave. I don't want to call it that.
But
you're a subject citizen more than a sovereign citizen.
So all the kind of patriot websites out there, and I certainly spent in my past studying some of this stuff and took course. I even took a year-long course from an attorney about how the federal government years ago, I don't know, 2008 or 7, something like that, I wasn't in the United States, right? I was in Texas, right?
Correct.
So he was theoretically right, but something I've learned from you over just in the recent couple of years, these people don't understand that you're not on the couch.
Correct?
Yeah. So they teach this stuff.
As if you were.
As if you were on the organic couch.
Right. And then the judge essentially looks at the case and says, oh, you have a Social Security number? Oh, you have a bank account?
So you mean a bank account and all these things are adhesion contracts?
Yes.
Driver's license?
Yes.
Passport?
Yes.
What else?
Well,
man, you're on the plastic.
A mortgage?
Really?
The Fannie Mae mortgage?
Really?
Yeah, I mean, there's
you're plasticized, dude, right?
Yeah, you're in the forum. Now, granted, you can separate yourself, as many have done.
Really?
But it's just not easy. It's not like it's a piece of cake, like you can fill out a few forms and you're done. And I've followed the same course of study.
I know you did over
you know,
years.
For 40 years.
You know this stuff. Yeah.
Right. And to me, at the end, I decided you'd be better off to understand the system and use it to your advantage, what little they provide for you. Because if you want to be a renegade and say, well, I'm not a U.S. citizen, I'm not going to pay an income tax, you're not going to legislate for me, and none of your federal laws apply.
You spend your whole life doing that, right?
You'll be spending your whole life fighting. Yeah.
Right.
And you won't be able to enjoy any of the benefits, see, because that is the other thing.
They allow you to
monetize debt and buy a house. They allow you to participate in open equity markets. They allow you to have bank accounts and transfer wealth through Federal Reserve notes, which all by themselves put you in the jurisdiction.
So if you're on the couch, you're kind of growing food organically and dealing in cash and and not have a bank account, not have a driver's license. And you're just kind of off the grid.
Yes, as they call it.
But,
then you can take what shall we call it? The radical stance.
Radical stance.
And you can defend it. But if you're in, don't try to act like you're out, because now you're going to find yourself at the short end of that stick, and it's not a pleasant one to fight. Uh-huh.
So you got like 1 foot in, 1 foot out.
Yeah, no good.
You're either in or you're in or you're in or out.
You're either in or you're out. Don't try to be in the middle.
So if you really want to be a radical hippie and not have your kid do any of this stuff and live out in the country.
Well, first thing you need to do is learn.
Constitutionally or legally?
Yeah.
Could you do it?
Yes, but you have to learn why it is.
Yeah, you'd have to really know your stuff.
Yeah.
What would the kid do his whole life or her? Whole life?
Right.
Well, you could grow food. That wouldn't be terrible. Let's see if this question is about what we're talking about, because we're going to end. Did you have a question about the couch and the plastic?
Well, I thought I'd chime in on the argument a little bit, but you seem to have covered it all pretty well.
Oh, have we? Did you have any other questions or comments for us before we leave? Where are you calling from?
Washington. This is Mike up in Mount Vernon, Washington.
Yeah. Any other ideas something you want to ask Andrew about or have a comment about, Mike?
Well, no, not really. I was just going to say that, you know, if you look up the definition of person, it's basically any subject of rights and duties. Well, what creates a U.S. person? I mean, what creates a person anyway? It's a contract, right? It's an agreement that where somebody's bound to do one thing and somebody's bound to do another, and that creates this legal fiction called a person. If you have a contract with the United States and the District of Columbia, which the most obvious is Social Security, then you have created this person, and you're just bound to that. The issues that are there, like Andrew was talking about, the benefits you get, you know, from being able to monetize debt and so on and so forth. You know, if you're that person, then you're bound to the law of that jurisdiction. And it doesn't matter whether you live there or not.
You agree, Andrew?
I do, absolutely, 100%.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just trying to give a little bit different take on it that might help people understand better. You know, You haven't lost your state citizenship. You're just involved in something else that kind of negates it.
Supersedes it.
For all practical purposes.
Like, right, because that, the former springs from the latter. So if you have the ability to become a person, then that had to start somewhere. And yes, your unlimited right to contract is what allowed you to get in that position. Now, here's the thing. Attorneys will tell you that any contract that you enter in which you are not fully aware of all the terms, you know, those terms can't be sprung on you after you sign the contract. Oh, by the way, you entered this contract and these hidden provisions apply and you don't know about them. That's constructive fraud.
Well, why wouldn't all this then be a moot point? Because nobody told us when we were kids.
Well, then, but what you have to do is sue for constructive fraud.
Oh, good luck with that.
You have to be the plaintiff, not the defendant.
Have people ever prevailed doing that?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely.
Really? Oh.
Yeah. There are people that are left alone if that's what prevailing is. So, you know, once they, that ultimately that would be the argument.
And after a huge amount of attorney's fees and all
they're
that.
They're never, or individual pro per, but they're never going to give you a ruling that gives you a victory. What they'll do instead is what most people want. They just want to be left alone.
Oh, I see. Yeah. Pretty interesting. Well, it's pretty curious how we got there. So, Mike, thanks for calling. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Mike.
Yeah.
Yep. You guys have a good day. See ya. Thanks for the show. I really enjoy it. I don't always get to listen live. Very seldom do, for that matter. But
podcast will be up in a couple hours. All right, Michael. Thank you. So there we have it. I think that's a pretty concise, 10 or 15 minutes things of the plastic in the couch. The couch and the plastic.
Yeah. The best book.
I was just going to ask you. Research
best book
about
on
that.
The subject. Yeah. Well, I talked about Otto Skinner's book, If You Are the Defendant. That touches on it a little bit. But Eustace Mullins wrote a book years ago, The Rape of Justice.
Wow.
And it explains essentially how we got into that forum. So that's a good book to read. And I think it's available online.
Oh, Eustace, man, he was something else, wasn't he?
Prolific writer, yeah.
Wow.
He really did.
And wasn't it true that the boys, Doug and Mel, we call them?
Well, they institutionalized
They locked him up, didn't
yeah,
they? In a loony bin, huh?
Yeah.
Wow.
Well, no, that, excuse me. No, that wasn't Eustace. That was his mentor.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Ezra Pound.
Ezra Pound.
Yeah, Ezra was locked in a institution post-World War II, and Eustace went to visit him. And Ezra said, you know, go to the library and look up this and go and look up that. And he just essentially gave him all the strings to pull on.
Mm-hmm. Eustace Mullins got some pretty cool books. What are they? Before we go, it is
World Order.
The World Order.
The Federal Reserve. Secrets of the Federal Reserve.
Secrets of the Federal Reserve.
The Rape of Justice. Those are three great books by Mullins.
Yeah, I don't have that one. The Rape of Justice. Probably should have run that one first.
Writ for Martyrs. That's another good one.
Man, he was all cool guy.
I have them all.
Mr. Goss, thank you so much. Andrew Goss, he does buy and sell gold coins for a living, just so you know. So if you call him up and ask him if you should buy gold coin, remember, it's like going to a as he says, going to a barber saying, do I need a haircut? But we appreciate that you've never been one of those crashaholics, collapsitarians, as we call them, saying that the whole thing's going to go into a trash heap, and that's the reason why you should buy in gold and silver. Never been one of those, and I've known you for 25 years. Never.
Well, but if we ever get to the point where we're heading for a crash, you bet I'll tell you. If it's my opinion that that's why you should do it, well, then I will.
Yeah.
But I'm not going to do that just to sell coins. No.
And your number up there is 800-468-2646.
That's right, yeah.
Okay. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, yes. Patrick Timpone and Andrew Goss, One Radio Network. We'll be here in the morning. We're going to have fun. We're going to do the a simple method for liver gallbladder flushes. A lot of the people make them very complicated. We're going to dive right into that. And also, who else is on tomorrow? I can grab it quick here. It's escaping me. Oh, the biome thing, yeah. Down in your tummy. Learn about the biome. This, the gut makeover. Pretty cool thing. That's going to be tomorrow. And that will be getting underway. 9 o'clock Central Time. Thanks to Sharon and to Lynn. And I love you guys very much.
Broadcasting from the beautiful Hill Country in Texas, this is OneRadioNetwork.com.